Good day and welcome to the podcast, To Be More. I'm your host, TJ Smith. To be more is exactly what we want, but it will take all of us to have the tough conversations and make tough decisions moving forward in order to see the change we all want. 2021 has come to a close, but sadly the violence hasn't. In the first week of 2022, Baltimore has seen several teenagers among its recent shooting victims. In fact, the first two murders and several shootings were all teenagers. 2021 closed out on a very sad and violent note, ending with 337 murders and more than 700 non-fatal shootings. Among the murder victims in 2021 were 69-year-old Evelyn Player, who was killed inside of a church by a repeat violent offender, two Safe Street workers, including the program director, Dante Barksdale, a DPW employee who was executed in cold blood in front of his children, who he was preparing to take to school, and police officer Kiana Howley. Officer Howley was ambushed just days before Christmas by two men now charged in her murder. Those same suspects are also accused of killing Justin Johnson just 90 minutes later. These are just a few of the murders that shocked the city and devastated families. The mayor, the state's attorney, and police commissioner had some strong words for violent offenders who continue to wreak havoc on the city. But the question remains, will any of the policy changes work? More than two-thirds of the country's 40 most populous cities saw more homicides last year than in 2020, according to a CNN analysis of police department data. 10 of those cities recorded more homicides in 2021 than any other year on record. And those cities include Philadelphia, Austin, Texas, Columbus, Ohio, Indianapolis, Portland, Oregon, Memphis, Tennessee, Louisville, Kentucky, Milwaukee, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Tucson, Arizona. And Minneapolis actually tied its previous record number of homicides from 1997 and in 2021. Unfortunately, Baltimore is among the two-thirds of the cities who saw more murders in 2021 than in 2020. But it's also important to note, Baltimore's surge in murders is now in its seventh year after it began in 2015 after the death of Freddie Gray and the subsequent riots. Cities around the country are scrambling to address the issue of crime, and this has quickly become a political talking point. Will 2022 bring about the change that so many want? Joining me today is Juana Brooks, a former assistant state's attorney for the Office of the State's Attorney for Baltimore City, where she prosecuted felony violent crimes. And John Deedy, he is a program coordinator and political science professor at the Community College of Baltimore County. Good day to you both, and thank you for joining us for this follow-up to an earlier conversation we had, but we have to talk about violence again. And I want to go, you know, straight to you, Ms. Brooks. From your role, having been an assistant state's attorney, there are a lot of people in the streets. I run into them often, and they think that there's already some sort of mandatory sentencing for gun offenders. Is that true? And what is the flexibility with it where we continuously see the same gun offenders on the street?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, TJ. And there is and there isn't, like a true lawyer, right? Spoken like a true lawyer. So, for example, one of the quote unquote mandatory sentences is if you are convicted of committing a crime of violence and there's a use of a handgun in that commission of that crime of violence, then the sentence is 5 years without. So meaning you theoretically, you're supposed to serve the 5 years without the possibility of parole or probation. But so to be clear, I haven't been a prosecutor in the city since early 2015. So I can't speak for how the office's policies currently handle that. I can say under the prior state attorney, and I was there also under Mrs. Chesney, who was the prior state attorney to that, for a prosecutor to, for example, for a prosecutor to on their own accord decide not to go forward on that count, the five without, meaning the person has to serve the 5 years, there was a certain level of overview and oversight. Our deputy chief state's attorney would more often than not have to meet with us, and we'd have to explain our rationale and what the reason for that was. And I want to make the point to say, at least my experience and my perception of it wasn't because the end game was somehow to make sure that we got all these convictions. The end game really always was about public safety. And what I have seen since then, and I can only comment, you know, as an observant, I don't know that those sentences always get imposed. But again, in all fairness, I can't, you know, not being privy to the details of the case, I certainly can't say if that's appropriate or not. But when we see the level of violence just skyrocketing and continuing to skyrocket in our city, it's challenging, right? Because we don't want to return to mass incarceration. We don't even want to go that route. But I think a lot of these issues sometimes get conflated, and at least my perception is that in Baltimore, unfortunately, the citizens are still losing when it comes to violence.
Right. And you bring up a good point about the mass incarceration, over incarceration, and we hear it a lot when we talk about mandatory sentencing. And the shift is really about violent offenders. We're not talking about thieves. We're not talking about substance abuse users or dealers, for that matter. We're talking about people who use weapons to carry out violent crimes against other people. And I want to shift to you, John, and ask you about the political ramifications, where it seems like you're seeing a bit of a difference in different areas of the country. New York, as an example, they had progressives running in their primary election, along with maybe more moderate candidates, like the person who was elected mayor, Eric Adams, who really came out strong. And I believe it might have been on New Year's Day of this year, where an officer was shot overnight by what appeared to be a random bullet. It seemed like everybody was on the same page, the police commissioner, the mayor, the union president, and it was about people carrying guns need to be held accountable. How do you see this politically playing out, where some politicians are a little softer? They're not ready to say we need to lock up these people who are carrying guns illegally in our city. Some aren't saying that in some of the cities across America. And Baltimore might be one of the places where you're not hearing it as much.
And, you know, when I think about this, Eric Adams won his race for mayor because he was a former police officer. And you know, the thing is, people will complain about the police, but when bad things happen to you, you don't call a plumber. You call a police officer. They're there to serve and protect. And I think where a lot of people, and Adams' appeal was, I'm a former police officer. I've been there, done that. And it is about safety. People can talk about, you know, caring about other issues, but personal safety is always in the top two or top three as far as issues. And in Baltimore, unfortunately, I think really the tipping point of change was what happened with the Freddie Gray situation. And you've seen the spike in crime. You've seen a mix of police officers being afraid to be police officers. And you've seen a situation where it sounds like a good idea on paper. We're not going to prosecute petty crimes like selling, you know, weed on the street and things like that. But I was talking to my optometrist a few months ago about this. And he said, the problem is you get all these people loitering around your business. And then no one wants to go into your business because they know that the police aren't going to do anything, because what's going to happen is that they won't be able to prosecute because the state's attorney won't do anything. The gun problem is very serious. And I think that there has to be more of a bullhorn or a drumbeat, really, to enunciate that this is where it has to be tackled, because these aren't violent crimes being committed with other weapons.
Right. And that's, you know, again, jumping in here and putting on my law enforcement hat. It was Thanksgiving Day. My grandmother's home that we celebrate Thanksgiving at is in Northwest Baltimore, and had to go down to the corner store to get some aluminum foil. So my cousins and I go to the go down to the corner store, and there are several people loitering in front of the business. As we approach, he said he had the fentanyl and had some weed and had some crack. And a couple of my cousins was like, how come the police can't move these people along? You know, they just gathered here. And it was, I think, a relatively mild Thanksgiving, but they were there for no lawful purpose. And the fact that I grew up in a neighborhood and watched how it went downhill and to see what was going on there, and you had to get buzzed into the store, and the store basically is being held hostage by the people that are gathering. But back to you, Juana, do decriminalizing the smaller petty crime, so to speak, quality of life even, do we think that right now, in your opinion, is the best time to do it? I know that many of us might agree that it could be a good practice moving forward, but is it a good time to do it right now with the level of violence? And it seems like they understand, and they, meaning the criminal element, understands they can get away with more, so they're taking advantage of more. Is that good right now? And in your day, did you guys prosecute or use more discretion as well when you did prosecute these things?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think those are really good questions. And I would have used the exact same phrase, the quality of life crimes. So when we talk about this, I actually think that in a way, well, just like everything else, I think it's actually multiple conversations, but the issues have been conflated into one. And what I mean by that is that when we look at the numbers, the majority, at least, and the numbers are that I'm citing are only as current as 2019 or thereabouts. The majority of folks in state prisons are actually there. So over 50% are actually there for violent offenses, right? And so where I'm going with that is that we've had this sweeping movement in the last, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, seven in Baltimore, where we see elected officials, in particular prosecutors, make these sweeping policies and come out with these announcements, letting the communities know that, you know, we will no longer be prosecuting da 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 da. Pick your laundry list of quality of life crimes. But what we haven't seen, and I'll speak for Baltimore, although I think that the numbers are consistent for Philadelphia and Chicago as well, who also happen to be cities with progressive prosecutors, what we haven't seen is a reduction in violent crime. So then the question becomes, all right, so does that mean because we're no longer arresting these quote unquote low level offenders, somehow the violent crime is either remaining the same or going up? No, not necessarily. In fact, the two may or may not even be related. However, here's the challenging part. The challenging part is that I think we're getting to a point, especially in Baltimore, where our focus is so much, and we should be focused on making sure that we're, again, this idea of mass incarceration and, you know, all the systemic problems that we all are aware of, and we absolutely should be working towards solutions on those. But our focus has been so, for our politicians, they're so largely focused on these talking points, at least that's what it appears to me. And they want to be able to say, you know, we're not arresting X kind of thing and this kind of thing and da 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 da. But the problem is, who's actually focusing on the violent crime then? Because what I'm hearing from the state attorney's office a lot of times, and I commend the Madam State Attorney for the work she's done as far as, focusing on conviction integrity, making sure that those folks who should be exonerated of crimes that they should never have been locked up for to begin with are exonerated, making sure that, you know, people have second chances. In fact, I would say probably third, fourth, fifth and chances. That's fine. All that's fine. But police in Baltimore City seem to have gotten in line with that. And quite frankly, I can't say that I truly fault, at least not the sort of like the, for lack of a better word, putting it the beat cop, right? Because administration, higher ups, command is telling them, and in fact, putting out memos saying, look, state attorney's office is not prosecuting these cases anymore. So you can still arrest, but if you're going to do that, we're going to need you to do this, and this. And as far as I understand it, you know, including possibly having to contact your lieutenant if you're a patrol officer and all this other stuff. When you put it all together, and you do have also an uptick in charging police officers with crimes, and I want to be clear about that, I support anybody being charged with a crime that's committed a crime, right? Especially because we do want to trust our police officers, and there's also the issue with the distrust between the community and police. But the problem comes in that the focus, everybody's focus seems to be on this idea of this, you know, quality of life crimes, although they don't use that term, and we're not arresting or prosecuting them anymore. Okay, fine. So to your point, TJ, when you're walking to the corner store, so what is the recourse for that? So when we have children going past the corner store or trying to get to school, and they are now in some sort of obstacle course around maybe somebody using drugs or dealing drugs. And I understand that this is sort of being a little extreme, but it's not necessarily completely unheard of. We no longer prosecute for prostitution. That's a whole nother story, because I think that's a mistake. I'm not saying prosecution, but something needs to happen, because I think we're going to lose a lot of folks to being sexually trafficked. So we're not dealing with the quality of life crimes by policing and prosecution. Whether or not we should be, we can have that conversation, but we're not doing it anymore, right? So the folks that live there, I'm not sure who they're supposed to turn to. And I think John made an excellent point. When you feel in danger, or when you have a little bit of a concern greater than a call to 311, typically you call the police. But now our citizenry, more and more, what's being reinforced is basically you can call us, but our hands are kind of tied. And by the way, if you are that person that called on your neighbor and maybe your neighbor did get arrested, think about it this way. Now you're going to the state's attorney's office. Everybody knows in there that you called, you know, whatever it is, the case became a case, it's a misdemeanor. The state's attorney's office isn't going to prosecute it. So you're going back to your neighborhood with the persons that you call the police on. And all of this is, again, quote unquote, misdemeanor, low level, fine. But the issue is also the skyrocketing violence. They more than likely, studies tell us that they aren't necessarily, mostly, they're not the same people committing these crimes. And they're very different kind of crimes. But the problem is, again, who is focusing on the violent crime? So back in my day, what I can say is that when it came to the low level arrests, we had a lot of programs and courts that were specifically created and designed to divert. So let's talk about the prostitution, for example. Under the previous state's attorney, a prostitution court was created. And the idea of it was not, let's go out, police officers, and lock up all the you know, individuals who are arguably or allegedly prostituting. No, I mean, it's so complex. So many of these things are complex. But by having, and I know that there's strong feelings around contact with police in general, but by having that contact with police, it allowed for a gateway into services. It allowed sometimes, for example, when, and I'll just for the purpose of argument, I'm just going to use regular terms of, you know, when a woman, let's say, for example, was, you know, had been arrested and was now in this position in court. Well, it allowed us sometimes to be able to have a conversation with her away from whoever brought her to court. And what I mean by that is oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, there would have been someone who brought her to court, and that someone was probably very much present, either actively or in the background on whatever corner she was on. And that someone was probably benefiting financially and in other ways from this woman's, I'll say enterprises. And whether or not this woman wanted to be involved in this, whether those were her choices or not, that became very murky. But guess what? She's probably not going to be able to tell you that comfortably on a street corner, which is kind of how it's handled now. So if you have someone who's being trafficked, they no longer even have the, in my opinion, the opportunity to come in contact with somebody in the prostitution court who then could get the services if the woman so chooses or the individual wants it. So I know that that was a really long-winded answer, but where I'm going with it is, I guess it's in stages. The violent crime must be addressed, and especially repeat violent offenders. That requires an all hands on deck approach. We need a prosecutor who's going to work with the mayor's office, who's going to work with the state, with the police department. But we also need politicians who are willing to say the tough things that aren't popular right now. And because nobody's saying them, we really can't have genuine conversations about solutions. So we have people who are basically held hostage. I think you said it, or somebody said it, in their neighborhoods. And we have children growing up in those neighborhoods who are just now just trying to get by and, like I said, get to school. We have societal issues that we're all aware of that need these long-term goals and approaches. But then we also have the violent repeat offenders that really, the two aren't necessarily, like I said, they're not the same people. So you can stand up and have all the press conferences you want about the people you're not arresting. But the studies have shown us that those aren't the people committing the violent crime anyway. Not right. Not really.
Yeah, thief is a thief. We know thieves are thieves. That's what they do. They steal. They want to break in your house and they don't want to encounter you. They want to break in your house and steal stuff and don't want to deal with a human. They want to go steal from a store.
But which doesn't mean that there should be no accountability, right? Correct. It doesn't always or often have to be jail. But not arresting at all, not prosecuting at all. Well, what exactly is the recourse for the victim in the situation? Because I'm not hearing anybody talk about that, and it's incredibly frustrating.
Well, victims is a huge point. It's a point that has to be spoken about often because there were at least, I have to use the word, at least 337 murder victims last year. But if we just look at the families impacted by those murders and then the non-fatal shootings and some of those people who were shot and wounded and they're non-fatal in 2021 will become fatal years down the line. And some of them won't ever be their regular self ever again. So that's just part of life. And transitioning, you were talking about the former prosecutor, the last prosecutor, who was Greg Bernstein. And again, prostitution, I think that's a great point of bringing that person off the street and having the opportunity to have that conversation away from the pimp, so to speak, that might be on that corner watching their every move in order to get information from them or rescue them from the sex trafficking world, which is huge in this Baltimore-Washington corridor. Yeah. And it can be a route to some other problems. And transitioning to you, John, as we talk about, you know, I don't know that there's much disagreement among reasonable people that there need to be some changes made in law enforcement and how that's done every day to ensure people are treated correctly. Of course, we won't all want that. We want to make sure the right people are getting arrested, the right people are being accosted even. But with things going so bad in American cities, as we read at the very beginning, we're seeing the pendulum swing and it's going from what I've illustrated a number of times, throwing a baby out with the bathwater. We're not going to do any of this anymore because this happened, versus finding the middle ground. And San Francisco Mayor London Breed became the latest official to execute an abrupt about face, announcing a public safety initiative that includes emergency police funding after moving last year to cut $120 million from the law enforcement budget. One of her quotes was, "It's time that the reign of criminals who are destroying our city, it is time for it to come to an end. And it comes to an end when we take steps to be more aggressive with law enforcement, more aggressive with the changes in our policies and less tolerant of all the BS that has destroyed our city." That was really strong coming from someone who was looked upon as this progressive, quote, defund the police type of leader.
It was very strong. And I remember when it was said, and I think a lot of these ideas about defund the police, which is a nonsense idea and other stuff, sounds good. But maybe the good thing is we put it in the practice and found out this is a nutty idea. And I think that a lot of people get frustrated and it does become a throw the baby out with the bathwater. This, we had one bad incident out of 1,000. So we have to redo everything instead of figuring out, how do we fix the one bad incident? And it comes from a variety of points. We do need better policing, better training. That is a very important thing. But we also have to build better community inside the police. And what I mean by that is have citizens feel confident in the police. Have the police, you know, I use the expression walk the beat. Be involved in the community where people see the police officer as their friend and not someone to be suspicious of. And, you know, when I think about what has happened the last several years in Baltimore, there was a time not that long ago, 20 years ago, when people had confidence in the Baltimore police, when Ed Norris came in, made a lot of changes, did a lot of things that maybe today aren't necessarily politically correct, But people felt, you know, that the numbers showed things were going down. And, you know, when they talk about prosecution and let's avoid prosecuting these minor little crimes, you can get away with that as long as people see the other end of it. If you're not going to prosecute minor things that are considered minor, like prostitution and the low-level drugs, you've got to have a murder rate in the low 200s. And I think what's happening is a lot of people see what's going on. They're seeing they're not doing A, so we can try to get away with B. And I think that's part of the problem. I saw recently an interview with Michael Harrison on CNN. And one of the things he talked about, one of the problems, and it relates to COVID, is when COVID hit and they shut down the courts, a lot of people, it's like they never got their court date. So they're like, yeah, I didn't get my court date. And they're postponing it. So I've got more free time on my hands. I'm out on bail. They're doing other stuff because there's no immediate consequences for actions. And that's one of the problems, that you have to give a better perception to people showing, look, we arrested this person on Monday. There's a court date coming up in a few months. We are progressing quickly. And when people see that, what's taking so long? Why is this going on? Why can't we have quick prosecution? People are like, well, gosh, if they're not taking the time to prosecute, then people feel that things are out of control. You know, for the criminal, the longer you wait to prosecute, the more of a chance they have to get off on those charges, because people's memories fade, people don't show up in court, et cetera. You have to have a perception among citizens that things are happening, that there is movement. Maybe not necessarily, people may say it's good movement, but if people feel there is action, there's energy, that something is actually happening, that there are results, that people will feel better about things, you know, the perception versus reality argument. Right. And I think that if Baltimore wants to get to this place of basically improving policing, but also with the public, you know, you need to have elected officials out there more often talking about these things. And unfortunately, they're not there enough. And I'm not just talking, you know, a mayor or a city council president, but the local city council leaders need to be out there more talking about these things. Maybe need to be more active in the community working with the police. There's a variety, you know, there's not one magic silver bullet answer. Wish there was. But they have to do a variety of things. And the program Mayor Scott came out with in July, there were a lot of good things there. The problem is getting the buy-in from local residents. And that's the problem. I don't think he's done a very good job of selling this plan. And selling the plan consists of talking about it all the time and having it a prominent thing on the webpage when you go to his site.
And that's the group violence reduction plan that was instituted in Oakland, California some years ago. And they saw some reductions as a result, or at least they used that and say as a result of that plan, they saw reductions. And, you know, in the mayor's defense, he is out there. And I think you hit the nail on the head. It takes a collaborative approach. And we, in my opinion, see a bit of a disjointed approach right now where it's not everyone. It's not everyone on the same sheet of music looking at this as one of the biggest problems, because one of the other factors here in Baltimore, for instance, is the population declining. In 2021, that is, again, going to be a record year per capita with murders in the city, about 58 per 100,000. And that's the highest number, at least ties for the highest number of murders per capita in the city yet again. And there are very few cities that have a higher murder per capita number when we talk about big cities. St. Louis, they actually dropped from being in the 80s in 2020 to being at 65 per 100,000 in 2021. Still outrageous. And we're talking about a city of about 300,000 people that's often compared to in Baltimore. But then continuing with you, John, looking at places like Philadelphia, which, you know, ironically, we saw the headlines coming out of Philly and how many murders they had. More actual people died this year in Philly via murder, homicide, than ever before. However, their murder rate is 37 per 100,000, so still 20 below Baltimore, even if as they hit their record high this year. Their former mayor, Michael Nutter, came out really swinging pretty hard at their prosecutor, Larry Krasner, about his policies and the way he's going about things. What are your thoughts on that? Does that cause more problems politically and in the city? Do regular citizens even care about that stuff?
Unfortunately, sometimes regular citizens don't care about crime until the day they become a crime victim. And there has been a lot of criticism of what has gone on in Philadelphia, but ironically, the guy got reelected last year.
Right.
And by overwhelming numbers. And I think this goes back to a feeling in a lot of cities of mistrust among the police. And, you know, Marilyn Mosby, one of her political successes has been really taking a stance sometimes of being against the police. And citizens at times have embraced this idea of the police are the problem. And that's how you have problems with law enforcement, because if you're a police officer and people see you as the problem, it's like, I've got to be very careful about my own policing, but is it worth the risk to do other things? And when you have a situation, Baltimore's declining population, and you have a rising murder rate, that is an awful situation to be in. And I think that there has to be more of a perception and a reality of action by political leaders. You know, the problem is when it's only what is seen as a horrific tragedy, when a police officer or a young child is killed, all of a sudden the alarm bells go off and everyone says, now things will change. The problem is that hasn't been happening. There hasn't been the now this will change things. And I think that what's happened is we've had two generations of apathy among citizens to where, well, this is how I live. You know, you're conditioned to how you live. And when you grow up in a society where, you know, people are on street corners, when you grow up where murder happens in your community and it's been generational, you look at it as, well, this is the way I live. This is the way life is. You don't know any different. And that's a problem. Whereas people in the suburbs say, look, if something like this happened here, we'd be going absolutely crazy. And I think that you have to change the perception to get people more involved, because when you have people conditioned, this is the way it is, it creates apathy amongst people. And what happens at times, they throw up their hands saying, oh yeah, murder rate's 300. Well, you know, that's the way it is. And that's a problem.
Well, it really hasn't been much time to be outraged here, unfortunately, because something more outrageous happens next. And the end of this year was a perfect example, or the end of last year, I should say, with the violence that we saw with Evelyn Player, as I mentioned earlier, with Officer Holly. So much violence happening at one time, you just forget about what happened the preceding week. And, you know, restorative justice is a thing, something I believe in, but we don't seem to have the resources to really put the rehabilitation and everything in place that's necessary to try to put people on a better path who are making some small bad mistakes. So the decriminalization of things, but where are we sending them? What do you see in that, Juana? I mean, again, is that part of the problem where people are getting these second, third, and fourth chances without any consequences now, even though there might be a good reason, it might be a good thing, but is that infrastructure really in place to ensure there's follow-up so that that person doesn't continue down that path?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an excellent question. And it really, you know, like everything else, everything is tied in all together. And I want to go back just very quickly to something, a point that John was making, and I agree with it. I'm going to expand just to say what we've seen and heard a lot in the last few years in Baltimore is almost, I would call it sort of politicians almost basically encouraging citizens not to trust the police. I want to be clear about that to say that in many cases, unfortunately, was born out of experiences that are real, right? Like we're very familiar with the extent of issues and problems that still need to be addressed in the police department. But one of the things that I am very concerned about is that who is actually doing anything to try to repair any of not just the damage in relationships, but the actual things that need to be fixed inside the police department. And I'll try to be quick about this, but we have a police department that's under a consent decree. They have come up with a bazillion policies in the last few years. I don't know if you all have had the chance to really look at some of these policies. Some of these policies are, and it's not a matter to joke about, but I jokingly have said that they're the equivalent of an LSAT problem. The things that they are sort of putting the onus on these officers of like, well, if this, then this, then this, then this. You have patrol officers, you have a shortage, and you have a city that is under siege by violence, and you want these guys and gals to do 15,000 different things before you can do this one thing. It's not reasonable and it's not practical, and it does have an effect on public safety, but it also creates further distrust because the average Jane and John on the street, they just know, well, police, they don't do anything. They're not doing their job. They're not doing this. But you have a culture where our politicians are encouraging us to distrust the police. So my question still always goes back to, so whose job, and also separately, perhaps the same, but whose focus is the violent crime component? Because we again, going back to the prosecution, the issue that I have with, at least in Baltimore, the way it's been handled, you have press releases to let folks know that you are no longer prosecuting a litany of things. That actually might be fine. You might not have to prosecute them. But I guess my question would be, why not do it on a case-by-case contingency? So what you've let be known, it sounds to me like it doesn't seem to matter to you if this is, to your point, although it's long-winded again, I don't know that this, if this could be the person's fifth, sixth, seventh, theft or something that's been reduced to a theft. So that means it was a more serious crime to begin with. But based on the policy that's been put out, it's just a blanket policy. We're no longer prosecuting drug possessions in Baltimore City. It doesn't matter what kind of drugs, and it doesn't matter the amount that you have. So as a former prosecutor, I know too well that oftentimes we reduce felonies from a distribution to an attempted distribution to now it might be a possession. Hey, is that the right call? I'm going to leave that to the side. But to your point, what we're doing is again and again and again, again, it's a revolving door. So then you have to look at it as, well, whose benefit is this for? Who is gaining from this? Because certainly still resources are being expanded. And with those low level offenses, although I've heard the state's attorney's office make this argument about that part of it is that they don't want there to be contact, unnecessary contact between the police and some of these folks. Well, contact is still occurring because the police have still instructed their officers to still stop the folks, to still collect their information, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's really irrelevant in my opinion. But also there's no one actually speaking up and looking out for the community, for the members of the citizens of Baltimore City. And to be clear, to me, it doesn't much matter if the people are often the same in the sense of, people unfortunately are often victimized and maybe, at another time in their life, they may be an offender or at least one of the low level offenders. I don't think that makes any difference. I think we have to treat the level of violence with a sense of urgency, regardless of where it's happening. And I hate to say this, but I agree with what John said. I could be wrong. I don't believe we would find it acceptable if we had the level of skyrocketing violence unfolding in Roland Park, Guilford, and Mount Washington. I do not believe that we would all just sort of turn a blind eye to it. And I'm not suggesting we're turning a blind eye to it, but all I'm hearing from our politicians is this constant talking point about, social justice, transformative justice, all those things are great. But again, if all of you are doing that, who is handling and focusing on the violent crime? And really, what are the citizens supposed to do? Because you've also told them, don't call the police. In essence, it's what you've done.
I'll add quickly. I thought that was a great point. Remember last May when there was a mini little crime burst in Fells Point? Mm-hmm. The business community went crazy. They demanded action. because the business community is money on the weekends for that community. And when they went crazy, all of a sudden the police are like, we'll be there. And for a couple weekends in a row, for a couple weeks, there was a strong police presence. There's not apathy in that area, but in a lot of other areas, unfortunately, it's apathy supreme.
Yeah, but I think, and I wonder what the two of you think about this, but there is some pushback to that as well from the rest of the folks who are you know, very much notable in these dialogues, this public dialogue. The pushback was, you know, obviously they want this increased policing presence for other reasons, not just because of the crime, but maybe because of the kind of folks that they are now seeing that they're not used to seeing and whatever else. And I do think sometimes it gets very complicated because it's not always a clear-cut answer. And, you know, everybody's human and everybody has these implicit biases and whatever else. But we also have gotten to the point where, on the one hand, it's good that we're scrutinizing criminal justice system, policing. I think everybody, I think for the most part, many people agree that reform needs to happen. But where there's a real disconnect is, you can reform, and we should reform the police and the criminal justice system and still get a handle on the violence and the violent repeat offenders. Both things can happen at the same time and should happen.
And it seems like that pendulum has swung one way dramatically.
Yeah.
And I'll use the word unfortunately. I can foresee in some cities, you're probably already going to see it, it's going to swing all the way back the other way. And we're going to be right back where we started, with maybe less than enough accountability, which is where the outcry has come from to begin with. And that's a significant concern, because we can do both. We should be doing both.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really look at the murder maps over the years, I hate to say it, but the reality is you could take a murder map from 2021 and compare it to 2010. And the murders are still happening in the same communities that they've been happening in. It's just more of them happening. So instead of three in a 1 mile square area radius or what have you, now there are 5 to 7. And you multiply that times 10 across the city in these areas that continuously have them, you get 337 murders. And that's not good for anyone to witness, especially children that are coming up with this trauma.
Yeah.
And I want to just ask both of you briefly, do you think that we're missing some laws that should be on the books? And I guess a section 1A to that, should some additional discretion be taken from judges and prosecutors? Mm-hmm. Because if we have an expectation of that, quote, bad guy with a gun going to prison, and he isn't, does that discretion need to be looked at, or are there new laws that should be put in place?
I'm not sure if we need new laws right away. I think we need to kind of work on enforcing some of the ones we currently have that are not being enforced. And it goes back to, in many ways, not dealing with petty crime is a good thing because it clogs up the court system and it's a lot of probation before judgment. But in other areas, when you let a little thing go, and Ed Norris used to talk about it, the broken window theory, when you let little things go, bigger things happen. And I think that we need to have better enforcement of what we have now. As far as gun laws, I think having laws that relate to basically if you commit a crime with a gun, you have to really make that enforceable as far as the mandatory sentencing. I think pleading that away, you know, I understand why plea bargaining is done, makes a lot of sense in certain situations, but I think that it has to rise to a bigger level before we get to that point. I think that a lot of people in the state's attorney's office, past and present, they're doing the best they can with the resources they have, not the resources they need.
What do you think, Juana? Any more?
Yeah. So I don't think that we need new laws to be added. I think that we have a comprehensive amount of laws and of varied types of laws available to us. The issue comes in, are we using all of the tools technically available to us at our disposal, and are we using those tools wisely? And I would say that, unfortunately, in this moment in time, it's kind of hard for me to argue that we are. You know, I hear people talk about their conviction rates. I also hear the same people talk about the fact that, you know, they don't measure success by conviction. I don't necessarily have a problem with that, but I mean, number one, it's contradictory to say both, but number two, you have to have some kind of measurement, right? Like there has to be some kind of data. So telling me every year for 7 years straight that you got a 90-some% conviction rate, I definitely do not believe that most of us in Baltimore City feel 90% safe in any way, shape, or form. And you have over 300 people that have been killed, 300 people every year in Baltimore City for the last 7 years. There is nothing about that that is acceptable. But we do have laws available to us. I'm not a proponent of these blanket policies, which kind of is a way to say that I'm not really a big fan of a mandatory sentence per se. And I know that that's kind of vague, but what I mean is I am a proponent of each case has to be a case by case determination. Each case is not a case, it's a person. There are multiple people involved, right? We have the accused, we have the person that has suffered as the victim of violence. And, you know, and I'm sorry, TJ, and I know you know all too well, we have the fallout. We have the effect that it has on the family. But at the same time, there does have to be some accountability that I'm not really seeing, both, in my opinion, on prosecutors and on judges. You know, we have a lot of conversations. And again, the public and national dialogue and local dialogue has really had this focus, especially from the prosecutor's perspective, this progressive prosecution, progressive policies. And we can, and as we know here, there's a study from Hopkins and whatever else the study said. But again, the problem is that doesn't actually address the violent offenders. And I think that accountability is what we need all across, including in other city agencies. And again, so no, I'm not, I don't think we need new laws, but do I think the ones we have are being properly employed? No, I don't, because we would see some kind of improvement on the violent crime aspect. And I fail to believe that 337 families last year or somewhere around that ballpark would say that they feel things are getting better than they have been. And so for me, again, I land in the same place, which is like, you know, politicians, it's great to have these talking points. It's great to make up these policies on paper and shoot them out to all the people in the police department. But if you're not actually practicing what you preach, and you're also not actually acknowledging the reality of what people and what folks are dealing with in Baltimore City, then you certainly aren't talking about a way to solve these things. Not really. And I think that's a disservice. So, you know, I think more accountability for judges and prosecutors is what we need.
Did you have something to add, John?
Well, the one thing I'll add, you know, I agree with you. There needs to be more accountability. And, you know, you could alter data in a variety of ways. Say, look, I got a 95% conviction rate. If you're going to count, hey, I got a plea bargain out of the deal, or doing a variety of other things. And I think that the one area that would improve policing the most is, you know, I've talked about community involvement, get a buy-in, you know, the apathy problem. We need to do a better job of getting the religious community involved, the churches. Baltimore has a street almost on every church corner in the entire city. The religious community, I think, could really help the situation of getting involved with various youth programs, cultivating the community together and doing a variety of things there. If we could get a situation of maybe the police working with the religious community, the religious leaders, maybe we could start to see a turn in these things, because the religious leaders are very respected of all denominations in the city of Baltimore. And maybe having a buy-in with them, who have large congregations, can help alter and change some of the things in Baltimore.
And, you know, it's funny, I agree with you. However, the thing comes up again. we can have the police do. And I think that's part of the problem. A lot of the times when things get bad again, we go back to, we need the police to do. The police are going to need to, the police have to. And we already know that they're spread thin. We're trying to create that distance by not having the police involved as heavily. And, you know, I was a bit critical of the squeegee situation where oftentimes we saw police going out to encounter them. If we weren't going to handle it as a criminal matter, why did we put police in it? It should be every other entity in government that we have before police get involved. When police need to get involved, we should be in a position where we're allowing the police to do what police are charged to do. And that's enforce the laws and make arrests if necessary. But we're putting them on the front end. So to that end, you know, I think what you're saying is absolutely spot on. But we, in my opinion, probably would benefit better from having a different entity of government lead the charge in some of these areas. And program evaluation is also very critical. We can't just have these feel-good things because they sound good, look good, feel good, but are they producing the results that we want? And one of the things that's also very critical, again, we talked about trust. That's come up a lot, the trust between the police community. That's a reality, right? And as we've seen the results of the Gun Trace Task Force, more reports are going to come out. More movies and documentaries are going to come out. And every time you relive that, it makes you just say, ugh, I remember being there at the time. And I'm sitting there saying, I can't believe this stuff was going on. And if you were a citizen, a relative, or a victim of any of these individuals who did this stuff, it's going to be a big problem. It's going to be very hard to get the police back in those communities and develop that level of trust. However, I do believe Baltimore still gives the benefit of the doubt more times than not. And we need to allow the police to go out and police some of the neighborhoods the way the community wants them to police the neighborhood. Yeah. But I also wonder, is there an appetite to go back to some of the past? I think there is. But I think that the level of oversight, as we brought up earlier with the consent decree, is something that has to be discussed. So as we get to a point of wrapping up, I was curious about how our elected officials and police commissioner can reconcile some of their differences. It is always good, especially from a citizen perspective, to see them all together, to see them with the ability to stand on the same stage and give a similar message. But going back to New York and Mayor Eric Adams, the new mayor there who was sworn in at midnight, I believe, on New Year's Eve into New Year's Day, is really tough talk, really tough talking. But the new Manhattan DA is like the polar opposite of him. And it's very difficult for me to see how he can, you know, say we're going to hold gun offenders accountable. We're going to do this, that, and the other thing if they're not on the same page. How do we get to that point where we can hold everybody accountable to their jobs and reconcile those political differences with two elected officials and some that are appointed? And John, we can start with you.
You know, when you think about trying to get everyone on the same page, it can be very difficult, not only the situation in New York, but if you want to think about getting even Mayor Scott and Mr. Harrison on the same page, too, a lot of people feel that they're not singing from the same sheet of music in the choir. And I think that you have to figure out, you have to have the meeting of the minds where each person says, what is in our interest that we can agree on? And how to approach things. The problem is, unfortunately, it takes a tragedy, such as with the murder of the police officer only a few weeks ago, to all of a sudden get everyone to say something needs to be done. The problem is you have two people who believe something needs to be done, but maybe taking a couple different approaches. And the consent decree, which was a very good idea that needed to be done, you know, a lot of people want to use it as an excuse. This is hamstringing us. This is where the problem is. But I really don't believe that's the problem. I always believe a lot of these situations in Baltimore are the personalities that are involved, needing to work together, to come together in a variety of places, in the communities, in the political leadership, which I think is very lacking. One thing I'll say, I like this mayor a great deal. I think there's a lot of potential for a lot of good things that can happen in City Hall. The problem is when he came into office, he made a mistake of making a promise under 300 murders the first year. Instead, we were over 300, a little bit more than last year, which is gravely unfortunate in this type of situation. So you're going into year two. What's the goal now? And how are we going? What can be, you know, the murder rate is always the bar everyone wants to set. You could have robberies and a variety of other things go down 25%. No one cares. They look at that magic murder rate number. And it's important for each party to get together, you know, the not just, you know, Mr. Harrison, but also Marilyn Mosby, Brandon also in the room too, to figure out what can we agree on? What can we agree on that we need to do to work together to solve some of these problems? Because right now, it seems like everyone is on their own script until a crisis occurs. And, you know, you have this mix of Marilyn Mosby, her husband is city council president. There's thoughts of where their political career wants to go. And then you have the mayor who sometimes has to think about, okay, my number one political rival is here and his wife is here. So maybe you don't get the good results you want to get. So that political dynamic can really be a headache for getting something done. Also, you have a situation where I don't think people feel that Brandon Scott and Mr. Harrison are a good marriage, that basically that this is something that sooner when his contract expires, it's going to expire and we're going to be back at square one for looking for a new police commissioner. And I think that all these things coming together, there's not a magic, you know, in 2 years, things are going to get better. It's a long, long road. And if Mayor Scott doesn't get a lot of these things dealt with, because, you know, the buck stops with him in this type of situation, you're going to have in 2024 a new mayor. Simple as that, because people are going to want to see immediate results. They're not seeing those immediate results.
Right.
And I think that, you know, people want perception, and I'll use it this way. Catherine Pugh didn't scare people. I don't think Jack Young scared anybody. Brandon Scott hasn't showed that people are afraid of him. Sheila Dixon, people were scared to death of. Martin O'Malley, in his own way, people were scared of. And I think that you got to bring the fear to the table. Right. The fear that, hey, if things don't get better, someone's dropping the hammer and dropping it hard. And I think that that's one of the things that people have to see this year. They have to see where the mayor takes a big action or does something. I remember when the Baltimore riots occurred, and it was the Monday night, and there was a press conference, and Mayor Blake was there, and Brandon Scott was there. And I remember something he said. Someone asked him how he felt, and he said, "I'm pissed off." And that resonated with people because people watched it and said, "Yeah, that's how I feel." People need to see more of "I'm pissed off" in 2022, and also tangible results to back it.
Right. Yeah. A healthy fear is certainly not a bad thing, in my opinion, either. And sometimes it's necessary, especially when you're trying to really make the changes that are necessary here in the city. And this would be my final question for you to answer from your perspectives and your respective positions. Let's say, John, you were top advisor right now to one of our political figures, mayor or city council president or a city council person for that matter, and you had to give them some advice right now on what needs to be done, whether it was from a political perspective or whether it was from what they needed to do from an appearance perspective, what advice would you give them?
The number one advice I would give, no matter who the political leader is, the word is action. People want to see action. People want to see something happening. I remember when Martin O'Malley became mayor of Baltimore, and you know, one of the first things he did was he got rid of Commissioner Daniels. He basically said, this isn't working, brought in Ed Norris. The other thing he did was early in his administration, and this isn't related to crime, but it's related to perception and action. He organized a community cleanup, and he got out there and worked in the community to clean up the neighborhoods. Action. So I would advise political leaders, show some action, show that there's a perception that things are happening, that things are getting done. Not necessarily the action of, you know, showing up after the incidents occurred, you know, not necessarily showing up as far as action for the prayer vigils, but showing the action of, I want something done. You know, I'm calling for certain things to be done. You know, that perception where people say, hey, someone cares. Show the empathy that you care for the community and you want things done. Come up with some plan that basically will bring the community together to say, hey, we've had enough. It stops here. The buck stops here today. Show that perception that I'm here to get some. I would advise a political leader, I'm here to show that we're going to get stuff done, that there's a new day and we're going to make progress and we're going to move forward. Be there in the community. And I think that would be the advice I would give any political leader.
Juana, same question for you. Your top advisor brought in to consult with the state's attorney's office, and you're talking to the Madam State's Attorney and her deputies. What would you say to them candidly right now if they said, we want your advice? You were here with other administrations. We want your advice.
Sure. Well, so one thing that we touched on earlier is, you know, we talked about the fact that resources are generally scarce, and yet we want folks in these city agencies to do so much with very little resources. I will make the point that as far as the state's attorney's office goes, the budget has increased exponentially, millions upon millions upon millions of dollars more. And so I will say that as far as resources goes, you know, I certainly will say that I'm sure that there are still many people that are overworked and underpaid, but as far as where they spend their resources, that's perhaps a topic for another show. So the advice that I would give is that you can't play politics with people's lives. That's what I would give the advice on. So, you know, although the prosecutor, the state's attorney's office is an elected position, it is my opinion that especially in the last, probably this is a trend everywhere, but it's become a much higher politicized office, in my opinion. And although maybe there's no getting around that, just because, again, it is an elected position, it is an independent office. But the problem with that for me that I see is that policies seem to be made on a whim. You know, we have all this patting ourselves on the back about the fact that, you know, we're not arresting low-level offenders and look, violence hasn't gone up. Again, the two aren't necessarily, one is not, it's not, maybe there's correlation, maybe there's not, but I don't think there's any necessary causation between the two. So the advice I would give is there are laws and there is separation of offices of church and state, if you will. And if you don't like the laws on the books, you know, perhaps there's a different way to go about changing those laws. But the biggest thing is when you make these blanket sweeping policies that you're not prosecuting any of this of any kind, and you're making these announcements, in my opinion, what you're saying is in some way, shape or form, just about anything goes, because what you haven't done is put in place. So what is the community supposed to do with that? Even if they don't want the people arrested, the question becomes, but what are they supposed to do if they are suffering from a quality of life crime on top of suffering from the gun violence around them? So I would really urge the state's attorney's office to instead of doubling down on their approach, And instead of taking a bird's eye view at just about everything, at least in my perception, from a political angle, to actually go talk to the people in the communities. Because my perception from the events that have now been had after these policies have been made and announced, I don't think there's a whole lot of support in the way that the state's attorney's office thought that there would be. People do not have any means to get any reprieve. Again, they're suffering from the quality of life crimes, and they're suffering from the gun violence. So who is looking out for them? I think it's important for the state attorney's office to remember that, yes, they should be neutral in the pursuit of justice. But by the time you are indicting a case in the instance of felonies, by the way, because it is the prosecutor's office who goes in and indicts cases, you should be confident about the fact that this is a case that you feel solid in, and you should be not just okay with, but it should be it's an honor, really. It's an honor to try and hold people accountable and to put public safety of everyone first. Because if the state's attorney's office isn't doing that, then again, and I sound like a broken record, but who exactly is looking out for the community? Because at this moment in time, what I see is a great disconnect between the politicians and the community. So there seems to be some kind of a connection amongst our elected officials, and they're on this very similar talking platform, and a lot of the talking points are the same. And again, I actually don't even disagree with much of what's being said, but there is a huge gap in what's not being said. And that gap is the reality of what most people in Baltimore live through. And they don't have any place to turn. They can't call the police for multiple reasons, including the relations they may have had and experiences they had that were not positive. But they're also being told don't call the police by people we've elected. But they're not being told by the people that we've elected what the solutions are. And I think that's just a further recipe for disaster. So I guess in sum, I would just really urge the state office to reconsider its policies. And it has to prosecute crimes. It has to prosecute crimes, and it has to hold people accountable. Accountability can look a number of ways, but for violent repeat offenders, yes, some people are going to have to go to jail. And I know that's not a popular opinion, but you have to be comfortable with that if you're a prosecutor. Right. You should also be fair, but you have to be comfortable with that.
And thank you both for that. And I think that's really the key. I don't think anyone in a position that can send someone to jail, especially those of us who have been in the leadership roles, that's not, you want to do it if you have to do it. And we don't want exactly. to do it just to do it. And that's why you hear a lot of these conversations revolving around violent people, the people who are going to harm or take the life of another human being is the focus. And I think as we get better at making sure we invest in those restorative justice programs where we can actually put someone into a situation where they're going to come out better, as opposed to just giving them a blank check, basically, of, all right, don't do it again, then we'll see a better place, hopefully. But I know that we could talk about this topic endlessly. And I know we all want to see a better 22 than we saw in 21. But it's going to take all of us doing something different. And whether that's contributing through our areas of expertise, like here today, or walking the streets and engaging people, we all have a responsibility. So I want to thank you both, Ms. Juana Brooks and Mr. John Deedy. Thanks for being with us today. And to all of you, as we aim to be more. Until next time, take care.